and you are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And just before we get into our next interview, a warning that this will include themes of sexual harassment and gender-based violence. So if you do need to speak with someone for support, you can always call the Sexual Assault Crisis Line on 1-800-806-292, 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-742, Lifeline on 131114, and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners can also call 13YARN, that is 139276. And to find out more about your rights at work and reporting instances of sexual harassment in the workplace, visit respectatwork.gov.au. We are now joined by Professor Marie Seagrave, Dr. Siru Tan, and Dr. Chloe Keel as part of 3CR's dedicated programming across this year's 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence to talk about their co-authored research into migrant and refugee women's attitudes, experiences, and responses to sexual harassment in Australian workplaces. They were involved in a research project in a collaboration with ANROS, and it was a national study that sought to investigate and document migrant and refugee women's experiences of, understandings of, and responses to sexual harassment. Professor Seagrave is an ARC Future Fellow in the School of Social and Political Sciences in the Faculty of Arts at the University of Melbourne. Dr. Tan is also based at the University of Melbourne and is in a lecturer in Criminology, Social and Political Sciences, and a co-lead of the Borders, Migration and Gendered Violence Research Hub. And Dr. Keel is a lecturer in criminology at Griffith University. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us, and I really appreciate your patience. So I just thought that we could start off by contextualizing the research project that you co-led in partnership with ANROS, Migrant and Refugee Women's Attitudes, Experiences, and Responses to Sexual Harassment in the Workplace, by talking about the impetus for this work. So prior to the national study, how well documented were migrant and refugee women's experiences of workplace sexual harassment in Australia, and what concerned you about this information gap?
So thanks for having us, Priya. I'll take this the first question. Yeah, so prior to the study, the sort of main and formative piece of work that really captured experiences of workplace sexual harassment was the national study that was done by Australian Human Rights Commission. But in that piece of work, there was also acknowledgement that it is limited in its capacity to speak to migrant and refugee women's experiences as a result of the study's design and reach. So it really relied on that single variable of language spoken at home as a mark of cultural and linguistic diversity. It also relied on English as the sole language for surveying participants, which then obviously excluded women with limited English proficiency from participating. And really, you know, the motivation for us in doing this research is to fill that recognized gap regarding the specificity of migrant and refugee women's experiences, which is obviously not being adequately captured in national data sets. And we have developed this research to support the development of a more, if you have it, a more comprehensive national picture of workplace sexual harassment as experienced by women who identify as migrants and refugees, and which can then inform strategies and policies nationally within key industries and settings. And in addition to language and asking questions to measure migrant and refugee women's experiences of workplace sexual harassment, alongside their attitudes, understandings, and responses to these behaviors, what we also wanted to do was to capture how structural insecurity of temporary visa holders and how things like insecure migration status or insecure employment, which is linked to their migration status, can be used as a leverage to exploit and sexually harass workers.
Yeah, and I think getting that multidimensional picture is so important because, as we'll be discussing, it is these sort of intersecting and compounding vulnerabilities and marginalizations that these women experience that do really make it so difficult for women to both speak up about and seek redress for sexual harassment in the workplace. And just to follow on the actual research process, Chloe, I was hoping you could take us through how you went about conducting the research, as I can imagine that this data collection did raise some significant practical and ethical challenges in your efforts to conduct a study that was both rigorous but also sensitive to the women that you were working with.
Thank you. So Siru has touched on a couple of these issues, but what was really clear from our knowledge when we looked was there's no national study that really sought to kind of understand these experiences of migrant and refugee women. So our study was designed with two phases to combat this. And the first was this national survey that was designed, I'll speak about in a moment. And then the second was the focus groups with over 155 migrant refugee women across Australia, and then there were 25 stakeholder interviews. And so these two phases kind of complement each other. So the survey allows us to get these insights of prevalence and frequency and intensity of sexual harassment in the workplace. But the nature of a survey means it's quite limited in capturing the breadth of those behaviours that women experienced. So the second stage really allowed the research to understand that complexity of those compounding factors that you mentioned and in regards to what it meant for the women we spoke to be safe in the workplace. Mm. And so when it comes to conducting surveys, to capture migrant refugee women's experiences, we know historically representative survey research has been quite limited in capturing those experiences of violence against women. So issues that Siri touched on slightly around kind of defining the population. So the methodological challenges with, well, what is a sample of migrant and refugee women? So for our research, we worked with an advisory committee and allowed this self-definition of migrant and refugee women. So if you felt you're from a migrant and refugee background or that was a part of your upbringing, you were included and welcome to take part in the survey. And that non-probability sample allowed for like a full inclusivity.
Mm.
And then in addition, having the survey offered in six languages really allowed the participants to express their experiences in a language that they felt most comfortable. So most surveys are really just conducted in English in Australia. And so we had about 11% of our sample conduct this in a language other than English. And the research that the team has done in the past has highlighted that this is really important multilingual research, especially when a quarter of the Australian population speaks a language other than English at home.
Yeah, absolutely.
So those are a few of the key points that we really touched on, and we really document this quite thoroughly in a very large and dry report, which is the technical report that accompanies the meat of the research findings. But this is kind of an important blueprint for future research to understand the key design issues we considered and how we resolve them, to make sure that we're really conducting research with marginalized and vulnerable women that's being developed and improved at the most high level of research design that our resources will allow.
Yeah, and I mean, as you've both already outlined, Siru and Chloe, this is so fundamentally important that you are creating these kinds of blueprints for better research to then be able to track how this issue progresses in the future. And Marie, I was hoping to turn to you to talk about how the final report of the research project synthesized a significant number of issues faced by migrant and refugee women being subjected to workplace harassment, with a couple of key cross-cutting themes that really kept jumping out to me while I was reading. And these are racism, the impact of visa status, and precarious or insecure employment status. So could you maybe touch on these in turn, given the specific ways that they do compound migrant and refugee women's experiences of an ability to challenge or seek redress for instances of workplace sexual harassment?
Thanks, Priya. Absolutely. And I think I'd begin by saying that, of course, all workplace sexual harassment is just unfortunately very common for all women across Australia, And one of the observations that we have, of course, from this study as well, is that women are managing this all the time. So even though we talk about it in terms of victims, I think one of the things to acknowledge is how much women are constantly managing this and pursuing careers or sustaining their family, sustaining an income, whilst managing workplace sexual harassment. And I think that's incredibly important to highlight in thinking about, especially some of the findings. When it comes to things that were really important for us to highlight, one of the things to say is that workplace sexual harassment is not often experienced in isolation. It intersects with other experiences. So for this study, what was very clear is that participants in this study experience workplace sexual harassment and at the same time see that both as focused on their gender but also focused on their race. So it's driven by racial discrimination. So the intersection of those experiences is incredibly important if we're thinking about how to respond. And racism, as we know, is a structural issue. We've just had the Racial Discrimination Commission release a plan dedicated to that. So one of the things that we really sought to highlight was that this sits alongside any commitment to workplace sexual harassment. But what was also clear, because the study was very large and tried to capture a whole range of experiences, other structural issues are very important to understand in terms of what sustains and compounds experiences of workplace sexual harassment, but also the choices women have in terms of managing or doing something or complaining. So for example, your visa status, if you are not a citizen or permanent resident, that absolutely compounds what you can do about your experiences in the workplace. If you know you need this job and there aren't many other options and you're a temporary visa holder, you are both likely to be a target but also less likely to be able to do something about it because of your visa status and the issues around accessing work. Similarly, anyone in any kind of precarious labour, contract work, gig economy work, those systems are not set up to support you if you complain or if you seek to do something about it. And I think those things really highlight for us that any effort to address workplace sexual harassment cannot be only about the conversation we have about workplace sexual harassment, but also people's experience at work, their location within the workplace, and more broadly in relation to things like their visa status. So those findings really suggest that any effort to address workplace sexual harassment requires addressing all of those things together and recognising that while women all across Australia are experiencing workplace sexual harassment, what compounds and sustains that and what impacts women's choices is quite different, and we need to understand that.
Yeah, and I guess on that issue, there is such a clear difference between knowing your legal rights and actually being able to exercise those rights in situations that are already characterized by such significant power imbalances. So very briefly, Chloe and Siru, could you speak to the extent to which the women you surveyed and interviewed knew their rights on the one hand and then were able to protect themselves on the other?
I can start with some of the what we found in the survey. So in terms of really knowing what behaviours were not okay, the majority of the women that we surveyed really considered the behaviours we listed as sexual harassment and believed this was a problem in Australia. But as Marie has highlighted, for migrant and refugee women, workplace sexual harassment really intersects with these other elements of labour exploitation and discrimination that are often not considered. So in terms of the connecting kind of behaviours that were defined by the Human Rights Commission, women connecting those with their women's own experiences, this was quite complex. So women often questioned their experience, and there was this process of understanding, like something that happened to me earlier in my career, I'm now realising that that was completely unacceptable behaviour. So in terms of kind of protecting themselves, there were power dynamics where we saw men were most likely the harassers, and men were often, these men were often in senior positions, or they were clients or customers. So we had 37% of the women in the sample who did not tell anyone, which is partially feelings about uncertainty about what to do, but also feeling, as Marie highlighted, that this would impact their employment. So these informal supports were more often relied upon than formal kind of rights and workplace responses, because those formal responses were routinely understood to lack transparency, not acknowledge harm, and often put a huge burden on the women who were complaining.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's quite, you know, when speaking to the women in the interviews, it was quite striking that it wasn't that they didn't know that what they were going through were, like, for some women, what they didn't, it wasn't sexual harassment. But also, I think one question that some of them did ask that posed to me was, what else can I do in this situation if I'm the primary income earner? And would this jeopardize my employment? Would this jeopardize my stay in the country? And I think this is where what Marie spoke about, this is all connected, that you can't just be focusing on workplace sexual harassment and not look at all of those other structural factors that shapes their decisions about how they should respond.
Mm.
And I think what was quite interesting was maybe they didn't always classify or talk about their experiences in the language of workplace sexual harassment. They spoke about uncomfortable experiences, and that was also something that stood out to me in terms of them talking about what they were going through. They knew that that wasn't quite right, but also that sense of what can I do in this situation, mm-hmm. because there's all these other practical considerations that I need to be holding, that I need to be considering. And a lot of them decided to just hold it out until they found better work or they got a more secure migration status.
Yeah, and it is just, you know, it's so challenging and heartbreaking for the women that are enduring this when they are facing so many compounding responsibilities and obligations. And just in closing, because we're coming to the end of our show, but Marie, could you just speak very briefly on positive duty obligations? Because they were introduced in an amendment to the Sex Discrimination Act in 1984 in December 2022. What has changed there, and can you talk about the holdup in implementing these?
Well, absolutely. Look, I think the thing to say about positive duty is that the intention is to shift responsibility. So rather than always waiting for women to complain, it's putting the obligation back on employers to be proactive, to be responsible for creating an environment that doesn't enable and sustain workplace sexual harassment. So the idea is a good one, but it has its own challenges in terms of how well it's going to work. While the legislation did come through, it came into force this year. So we haven't really started to see how well it's working. I would note that the Human Rights Commission have really indicated through their engagement with this work, through the engagement that they've done with community, that they're very aware of their job in terms of monitoring how well it works and also supporting employers to think about positive duty isn't one thing. So once you use research like this to inform what you're doing, it really becomes quite clear there needs to be a diversity of strategies. Not all women are in the same place. So there's much more to be done and to watch in that space.
Thank you so much, everyone. I really appreciate your time this morning. Apologies again for cutting us short, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Priya.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.